Well, can I welcome everyone here this evening? This is the last of the series on modernity. And I hope some people here would have been to the others. I've chaired most of them. I think it's been a really, really good series. There are still seats around in the middle and on the left there. Maybe people could shove up so that people get in on the end there. Because otherwise they've got to push past you all. If you could move towards the middle, the people on the edges, it would allow the others. And this surging audience to come in. We ought to wait another hour and then it'd be a really big audience, Richard. Is everyone more or less settled? This is the final lecture in the modernity series. I think it's been a really good series and a credit to the intellectual life of the LSE. I'm very happy to introduce Richard Sennett, who I'm sure is already very well known to plenty of people in this audience. I first met Richard quite a few years ago in New York when I used to go and teach at New York University, where Richard at that time also taught, and for a long while also taught. Richard has an extraordinary intellectual career. At the time I first met him, he just finished writing a book which in its day was a very famous book, still I think much discussed, called The Hidden Injuries of Class, which was an examination not really of the objective kind of structure of the class system, but more of what the class system does to people on the level of everyday life. And I think this theme of the experience that people have of the downside of capitalism and the problems associated with economic deprivation, I think Richard's emphasis has always been on what it feels like, what it means to be in situations of deprivation. And I don't think there are many people really who've pursued this theme as effectively as he has. Of course, a lot of his work concerns urban life, and for this he's justly famous across the world. He's very modest, so he won't like me saying these things about him. He's famous, I think, because of his theoretical writings on the city. The most significant one is really, to my mind anyway, one of the most significant is the early one called The Fall of Public Man, which is about the closing up of urban space, essentially. And I think if you want to look for another theme in Richard's writings, the invasion of urban space by traffic, by the breakdown of traditional communities, the need to reopen urban spaces, the need to recreate humane urban areas is another continuing theme of his work. And that takes one right up to contemporary times through a range of publications like The Voice in the Eye, also about the future of cities, past of cities too, right up to his current book, which has been very widely debated in continental Europe, in the US and here, which is called The Corrosion of Characters, a person with a quite corroded character. I felt quite a lot of sympathy for this particular book. So there are a series of themes really going through Richard's writings, and as you'll know, Richard has joined the LSE on a permanent basis, and we're very pleased and proud that this has happened. It's a major addition, I think, to the LSE's already formidable intellectual armory, and we hope that he will develop the cities program, general spread of interest across the LSE and the city much more deeply, because we have a lot of new energy, I think, going in these areas to join up with the people like Tony Travers and many others who've established LSE as a center for the study of urban life. Richard is a variegated person. You see him sitting here, he looks like an academic, but he's not just an academic. For quite a long years he ran the New York Institute for the Humanities, in which really interesting groups of people were assembled, novelists, poets, musicians, spent periods of time there. Richard himself was also a musician of no mean repute. And he's also a novelist. He's written, I think, four novels. First one was called The Frog That Dared to Croak, and that was followed by a number of other fictional works. So you have in front of you a rather diverse character, but I think the sort of person for whom the term public intellectual is entirely appropriate. So let me welcome Richard again. His lecture tonight is called The Art of Making Cities. Richard Sennett.
I have to say that Tony has edited someone the first time we met. I played poker with him, and it's an experience I recommend to no one. And was cleaned out, and somehow it's been a metaphor of our friendship ever since. I actually am going to wind up talking about the subject of this talk as advertised, but by a very circuitous route. What I want to really talk to you about is the relationship between capitalism and the city. And I want to do this because, as I was preparing for this lecture, I thought it would be a good idea for me to try and put the two schizophrenic sides of my life together. One is an interest in space, and the other is an interest in class, and more generally in capitalism. And so this is kind of an experimental talk for me. And I'd like also to thank my colleagues and students in the cities program who have discussed various aspects of with me about what I'm going to talk to you about today. And I'll talk for about 50 minutes, and then we'll have about 10 minutes of questions. Is that right? You'll ask me impossible questions I can't answer. Yeah. So, I want to talk, what I have to say today on this subject applies as much to sociology, geography, and economics as it does to the visual realm, which is the linchpin of LSE's cities program. Try to understand what it is that we mean when we talk about urban studies and how it relates to the evolution of capitalism in modern life. The conditions of capitalism today are very different than they were a century ago when the formal discipline of urban studies began. And as we, obviously, the changes in capitalism have altered the city radically. But in my view, we've yet to really catch up academically with these changes in reality. A lot of our discourse about cities is rooted in a city that is in the process of disappearing. So the what I'm trying to do in this lecture is find a way to get some intellectual tools to deal with cities as they exist today. Let me begin by saying with some trepidation what I think are the cultural values of cities that make a city a positive form of social organization. And for me, throughout the course of my writing, there's really been two in number. One has to do with sociability. And it's no more and no less than cities pose to people the problem of how to live with strangers rather than people who are known, familiar. How to live with people who are unknown and different. And that particular problem of sociability is joined to a problem of subjectivity. And that is how to live with multiplicity in oneself. A very complicated environment, like a dense, diverse city, creates in all of us multiple identities. And it also creates riddles of unsolvable experience, of experience that can't be closed as it can be in more simple environments. For me, the writings of the French philosopher Emmanuel Levinas, though he was no urbanist, have formed a kind of bridge between these two values. Levinas, who was a French philosopher and also a writer on Judaism, asserted that when a person's experience is incomplete or multiply defined, he or she had need of others, others whom he or she didn't know. He called this the neighborliness of strangers. And I think the phrase aptly captures the good qualities of city life, or at least the qualities of city life that we'd like to bring into being, the notion of the neighborliness of strangers. And it's based on the notion that what is incomplete in oneself ought to turn oneself outward towards other people. Now, these values of sociability and subjectivity were played out a century ago when urban studies began as a formal discipline in terms of a dialectic between rigidity and strangeness. And I'm going to explain what that means to you. That is, a world in which rigidity and strangeness were intermixed and interacted with each other in such a way that they gave a particular inflection to people's experience of sociability and subjectivity in a particular way. Today, these two values, subjective social values, are played out instead in terms of a dialectic between flexibility and indifference. My argument to you is that a great change in capitalism has transformed the context of urban values. Contrast between then and now, between a dialectic of rigidity and strangeness to a dialectic of flexibility and indifference in the city, which I will try and make more objective and precise, though I have to say that I speak to you as a socialist critic of capitalism. That's another enticing discussion that Tony Giddens and I have had. This is a fourth way rather than a third way, but we won't get lost in that quite yet. Let me begin by saying something about what is the meaning of this idea of a dialectic between rigidity and strangeness. To understand it, you need to recall that though cities are as ancient as human civilization, that the discipline of urban studies is only a century old. The writings on cities that you encounter from Aristotle up to Montesquieu or to Rousseau tend to make a kind of transposition of city and society. There isn't really a discourse about the rural in Western social theory up to about a century ago, and conversely a discourse about the urban. What we call urban studies first took root in sociology and geography, and then spread to economics, political science, and more recently to anthropology. In sociology, we owe to German writers such as Weber and Simmel the first trenchant analyses of cities, and they're often thought of by urbanists as constituting a Berlin school of urbanism, which flourished around the turn of the century. This Berlin school, in turn, inspired in some of its American students, that is, Americans who went to study with Simmel and with Weber, a desire to work more collaboratively. And they did so at the University of Chicago from the 1910s to the 1940s. Now, both the Berlin and the Chicago schools took form in an age in which capitalism was undergoing a bureaucratic stabilization. In Germany in particular, the consolidation of state effort and private enterprise was highly advanced. The Bismarckian Revolution had begun to bite by the turn of the century, and cowboy capitalism, which marked most of the 19th century, was being brought under control. In the US, the massive formation of monopolies, which occurred at the end of the 19th century, was tamed only by new forms of state control and also by competing but large-scale, bureaucratically complex private enterprise. So what you have occurring at the moment that these people are looking at what is the urban, what is place about, is a context in which the extraordinary instabilities of 19th century capitalism are giving way to an effort of stabilization affected cities, and it affected what urbanists could say about them. Now, of course, Weber was sociology's great analyst of bureaucratic rigidity, but I want to delay discussing him for a moment to focus on the other side of the dialectic, that is, strangers and strangeness. This is Zimmel's territory par excellence. In a letter to a friend, he wrote about Potsdamer Platz in Berlin, which is an enormous square in the turn of the 20th century, nothing like what you see today with Sony Daimler-Benz carefully arranged. It was a jumble, an incredible melting pot. People died in its traffic every day. The crowds were thick, dense, very politically active. It was a place of great crime and great arousal. And about, as he looked out over Potsdamer Platz in Berlin, remarking about the cacophony of languages, strange costumes of people in the square, the contending political forces of various groups vying for the attention of the crowd, Zimmel wrote that, quite simply, the urbanite is a stranger. And what he means by this in modern jargon is that the urbanite possesses a quality of alterity rather than of difference. That is to say, alterity refers not to fixed categorizations, to something known, to a scheme of identity, but rather to the unknown, to strangeness. And it was in Zimmel's mind that marked the urbanite as a truly modern man or woman, plunged into a domain which not of difference in the sense of known identities, but into a world of alterity, of the unknown. Alterity is a provoker in Zimmel's writing. It's a force of great anxiety. It's an adventure, but it's also a fearful adventure. And he wrote that each of us bears this power to provoke that sense of unease by our unknownness to others in the crowd. Now, the power of strangeness, this power of alterity, which Zimmel defined as the very essence of urbanity. There are more seats somewhere.
Sorry.
This power of strangeness towards others makes sense in terms of the material conditions of Zimmel's time. First of all, there's an enormous amount of migration to cities like Berlin or to Chicago, urban-rural migration, and migration across boundaries of nations. But even more so, there's as yet no culture of mass consumption which unified people in the city as social subjects. That is to say, in this phase of capitalism, the consolidation of production through these bureaucracies preceded the standardization of consumption. And this meant that the social subjects' desires, tastes, and lifestyles were discontinuous and puzzling to other people. It's a very important point in the history of capitalism, that the standardization of production, consumption, are disjoint, so that in this world in which bureaucracies are forming, there isn't a sense of a social subject known by what he or she desires. Now, we could as easily cite these material phenomena in New York in the 1900 as we could in Berlin. It's an ex-New Yorker, I have to say now, like me. It's still a familiar world of immigrants on the Lower East Side squeezing hard against Wall Street, or to the north against a bourgeois wasp residential neighborhood around Washington Square. Who are these others? What did they want? For Americans, for supposedly old-time Americans, that is, people who'd been there one or two generations before, they were mysteries, they were social puzzles. And the immigrants found the natives also social puzzles. Now, what you need to know about this is that strangeness as alterity is a force which Zimmel celebrated in cities. Like Joyce or Proust, Zimmel believed the stranger is the bearer of a new freedom, a freedom of being cut free from identity. I give you an American example of what he meant. When Willa Cather finally arrived in New York's Greenwich Village in 1906, she, who had been haunted in small-town America that her lesbianism might be discovered, wrote to a friend, "At last, in this indecipherable place, I can breathe." And Simmel's own labors aimed at specifying just how, on crowded streets and squares, that freedom of strangeness, the freedom of alterity, played itself out. You can think, if you want an example closer to home, of Joyce's play with Dublin, with Leopold Bloom. It's all about defamiliarization. That's the sense in which Bloom becomes really a man of Dublin. Places which initially seem familiar to him are defamiliarized, and in that, he becomes an urbanite. Now, opposed to strangeness, then, this is the phenomenon, this is a kind of cultural mindset of these first urbanists. Opposed to strangeness, and in the same place, however, were those forces of bureaucratic rigidity. And we owe to Simmel's student, Robert Park, and to Weber's student, Louis Wirth, an analysis of how the organizational consolidation of capitalism could be related to the territory of a city. Both of them sought to depict an ecological division of labor, of land, excuse me, both of them, both Park and Wirth, sought to depict an ecological division of land based on the division of labor. It was an incredible advance in urban studies. The most interesting maps the Chicago School produced of the city, for instance, were maps where different functions occurring in the city were laid out, not of where people lived, but of what they did. And they sought to articulate, Wirth in particular, how this mapping of space in terms of functional division of labor was tied to the appearance of bureaucratization. This was a big intellectual leap, that if you bureaucratize a society, you articulate its division of labor, it must show up in the use of space. But there's obviously a dilemma here. That is, how can you have strangeness in the midst of ever more definition? The Chicago urbanists tried to resolve this ecology in relation to the figure of the stranger and the freedom of alterity by imagining the urbanite as a permanent internal migrant traveling through this ecology. Wirth, for instance, depicted the city as a mosaic of different roles in different places, what he called segmented roles in the spaces of the city. But he argued that the subject transcends his or her own roles in space. The idea of a subject superior to his or her surroundings is again familiar to us in the literary domain, in the writings of Wirth's contemporary, Walter Benjamin, specifically in Benjamin's figure of the flâneur. Perhaps a little less artily, although maybe I shouldn't put it that way. Wirth was interested in examples of this subject transcending his or her spaces. In the examples of second-generation immigrants to Chicago and in the city's nascent black bourgeoisie. Now, both these groups, and I should say that there was a black bourgeoisie in Chicago long before the great migrations from the South up to the city. And in fact, it was a bourgeoisie that resisted this huge migration of industrial laborers in the 30s and 40s, hated them coming, because they were people that had established themselves in the city, but begun to move around in it. And what interested Wirth about them, or the second generation of immigrants, was that both of these groups had begun in an ever more defined urban ecology. That is, they had lived in urban villages, but had become mobile across fixed territories. Chicago, for instance, in 1924, one of the great incidents in the city's racial history is the first time that a black woman in a department store was fitted by a white seamstress. This was an event that was in papers for months. It's that kind of transgression of where you belong, of territory, that seemed to Wirth to be the very essence of what it meant to be an urbanite. In the lack of a single definition of where you belong, he wrote, lies one's freedom in the city. So I hope you understand now what I mean about, at the beginning of our discipline, this dialectic between strangeness and rigidity. It defined the ethical compass of urban studies when it first began. Like any serious version of culture, for instance, the urban design of this time sought both to flee the anxiety of strangeness of the city, yet preserve the freedom of the urbanite, such as the founding writers in our discipline describe. It's a great drama, for instance, in Daniel Burnham's plan of 1909 for Chicago, which is at once an attempt to impose a rigidly functional order on the city, a geometric order, and yet in each of the city's zones to mix the different classes and immigrant groups that these zones contain. Or again, German and Viennese city planners were at once attracted and repelled by the Garden City movement. They were attracted by its healthy qualities. This is the movement founded by Ebenezer Howard in this country, which is basically a kind of socialist suburb. It's a simplification, but let it stand. And the Germans were also repelled by its infantile simplicities. Gropius wrote about this kind of withdrawal for the city, for instance, that it's humane but not urbane. So that's a kind of, that's where we began as urbanists. Today, many of the material conditions which framed the first era of urban studies a century ago still continue. The flood of immigrants into cities, for example. And we continue, as indeed we should, to think of alterity as a social condition which holds out the promise of subjective freedom, freedom from arbitrary definition and identification. But the larger conditions of capitalism in our time have taken a new turn. And this change in the political economy has altered both the nature of the city itself and the intellectual tools we need to understand our own times. And so I now come to the second half of my lecture. I hope you've gathered I'm a very, very long-winded lecturer, but I will try to keep this within 55 minutes. I want to talk now about the contrast dialectic we have today, which is between flexibility and indifference. When we talk about a new stage in capitalism, new, very suspect word always, of course, we're really pointing at two phenomena. One is of the globalization of labor and capital flows. The other consists of a transformation of production, that is, a transformation of institutions and bureaucracy, a rebellion against the bureaucratic rigidity which marked the capitalism of the pre-Second World War, and instead a search for ways of production which allow people to work more flexibly and less rigidly. How are each of these aspects of modern capitalism related to life in cities? Because a bureaucratic revolution, which had made capitalism flexible, is often neglected, I'd like to begin with this part of the story. And it is indeed a revolution, a transformation of institutional life in the last quarter century, which I think future historians will really make, will remark as the story of what happened to capitalism in our time. And let me just try and explain this to you informally, just using an image. What Max Weber thought about when he thought about bureaucracy was a triangle, a kind of hierarchy of power, which as you went, based on the division of labor. As you went up the hierarchy of power, fewer and fewer people occupied places in it. It's based on a famous comparison that Weber made between military and industrial organization, that you achieve efficiency only by shrinking the realm of command in an army as you move higher, and similarly that this would occur in a bureaucracy, so with some modifications also the principle of what we call Fordism in industrial production. the kind of bureaucratic revolution that has occurred, the revolt against that triangle, substitutes for it another image, which you could imagine as a circle with a dot in the center. And that is an attempt to create a center of power in organizations, and radiating out from it lots of activities which are not hierarchically arranged, at least not in that old Weberian fashion. It has really this kind of change three, this circle in the square, this with a dot in the square, three characteristics. It's marked by bureaucratic layer delayering, but even more the notion that there are no fixed positions in a hierarchy. As Paul Krugman has argued, that we are today seeing the first real revolt in flexible capitalism against a position, the idea and the reality first enunciated by Adam Smith, that each person should have a specified fixed task in an organization. Flexible bureaucracies, that's not the case. Secondly, flexible bureaucracies are in fact marked by internal markets. I'll give you an example of this in the Microsoft corporate, well, and I come back to this. And the third, marked rather than by giving people on this periphery of power, freedom, a new kind of power, which has to do with the relations between center and periphery. And let me explain these second and third points, but just giving you an example of how the flexible bureaucracy works in the Microsoft Corporation. As some of you know, the Microsoft Corporation attempted to suppress a part of my book, and they failed. So I now, without legal fear, can discuss this with you. It's an unbelievable, I would have shut it down, but that's another story. Break it up is enough. In a Microsoft Corporation, an internal market works as follows. If you want to start a new software program, that dot, the people at the small number of managers at the center, decides basically what the program should do and sets kind of production target code for basically how roughly how many lines of computer code off this horrible Windows software need to be generated for it. And then what you do is you send out teams of people to compete against each other to see who is going to arrive at roughly meeting this production target as quickly as possible. The team that gets there first or closest first, the production target's usually set very high and are very short term. The team that gets there first is amply rewarded with stock, promotion, and so on. The teams that come in second, third to the end are broken up, and oftentimes the members of the teams are fired. In other words, there's no reward for effort in this system. It's what economists call it, or what Bob Frank calls a winner-take-all market. Right? Just doing your job is no recipe for survival in a flexible corporation. One thing you want to notice about this is completely different than the logic of efficiency in an old-style triangular bureaucracy. Because now what you've got here is duplication of effort. You're not interested in making sure that everybody has has their little niche and that they put in their oar to the collective effort. You want results, and you're willing to have lots of people compete against each other to achieve them. I've been appalled to discover how much this same way of structuring flexibility, for instance, has invaded the British Health Service. National Health Service was reformed to create internal markets. So was the BBC. And what you understand about this is that this is not a system which is democratic, in that the dot at the center is still defining the outputs and ladling out the rewards. What's left to people on the periphery is innovation about how to get the task done, not what the task should be. Okay, that is basically the formal, these three things, the notion of no fixed position, internal markets, winner-take-all markets, and center-periphery power relations, basically the characteristics of a flexible bureaucracy. Now, it produces a changing dynamics of time, and I'll just tell you very briefly what they are. This is a system of bureaucracy adapted to the principle of no long term. What it means about actual work in such a bureaucracy is that people do serial jobs rather than pursue long-term careers. They can't, because the bureaucracies themselves are in such a state of internal evolution. They're being broken up, their purposes are changing. The widget corporation may not make widgets in 5 years, so on, that the notion of kind of linear narrative of work disappears. It creates, because of the shortening dimension of time, extraordinary problems of institutional longevity and loyalty. It's very hard to be loyal to a corporation which has no long-term loyalty to you. Fundamental principle of bureaucratic organization, and evinced by almost everything we know about downsizing efforts, that the surest way to decrease people's attachment to a corporation and willing to go the extra mile for it rather than themselves is to shorten the time frame of the corporation itself. This shortened frame of work in this flexible organization, finally, lightens fraternity. To have informal trust between groups of workers, they have to know each other. When you organize work into team efforts, teams last 6, 7, at most 8 months, people don't really, say when a crisis comes about, know who they can rely on, who's going to go to pieces. And it's one of the reasons, as I've argued in my book, that very flexible organizations, very resistant to union organizing. People have very, very superficial relations with each other as employees. The sense of fraternity is diminished by shortening the time of the labor process. So what I'm saying to you is that what you have in a flexible, in this revolution, is both, in thanks to the mediation of time, both a kind of illegible system, that is, it doesn't have a long-term character that can be read, and a system that is socially, in terms of sociability and fraternity and loyalty, quite superficial. And I've said all of this to you at great length for the following reason. My argument is that flexible capitalism has the same effects on the city as on the workplace itself. If I know one big thing about this subject, that's it. That flexible capitalism has the same effects on the city as in the workplace itself. It diminishes social attachment to the city, and it creates an illegible urban world. Just as flexible production creates more superficial short-term relations at work, this capitalism results in a regime of superficial and disengaged relations in the city. This is what it means to talk about flexibility combining with indifference. Okay? This is the point I arrive at now. Now let me explain it to you. Even by my own standards, I'm going to have to cut some of this at great length. This argument has that flexibility produces indifference has three parts. The first has to do with the sheer physical attachment to place. The second has to do with the standardization of the environment and the indifference which standardization produces. And the third has to do with the relation of family and work, as expressed in the relation of housing and offices. And let me go through this very quickly for you. First, let me talk about attachments to place. This is self-evident in a way. One of the things that researchers who have been working with me have been able to establish is that rates of geographic mobility are very high for workers in flexible organizations. I'll give you the example of service work, temp work, which we've just finished a big study on. Temp work, by the way, things like Manpower, Kelly Girls, I don't know what they are in this country. They're no longer called Kelly Girls because they're Kelly Boys now as well. But anyhow, these are the fastest, these temp agencies are the fastest growing sector of the American labor market. And what we've been able to do is find out and it shouldn't surprise anybody, it's one of those self-evident social science findings which are worth finding out, is that people who do temp work move around more than people who work for one employer. I'll give you just two examples of this. Nurses who work for temp agencies are 8 times more likely to move from one city to another in a 2-year period as nurses who have worked for only 2 employers during that period, move from one permanent employer to another. Mainframe servicemen, it's actually quite an interesting study, all this may sound deadly dull. Mainframe servicemen who work for temp agencies are 11 times more likely to move from one city to another than mainframe servicemen who change jobs from one company to another. What a whole raft of statistics like this means is that presence in place is shortened by the new time frame of flexible work. And the reason I bring this up to you is the more that flexible labor progresses, either through temp work or through the destabilization of organizations, we are all potentially in the position of being immigrants, internal immigrants, moving from place to place. The divide between the immigrant and the native is, to me, an extremely suspicious category once we introduce exactly the dimension of what kind of capitalism we live under today. There's a necessary weakening to attachment to place. Now, the second aspect of how flexibility can create a sense of, and now I use the term indifference in a rather more pejorative way, is not as self-evident, and it has to do with standardization of the environment. What I want to argue to you is that the standardization of the modern urban environment is not a consequence of industrial rigidity. That's an old Marxist way of thinking. It's a consequence of impermanent activity in the city. When I was a kid, when I talked to Marxist urbanists, of which there were, I think, 3 in the world, other than David Harvey, in Marxist places, the argument was always that standardization was an inevitable consequence of Fordism. This, I believe, no longer is the case. And I want to explain to you why standardization is a result of an economy of impermanence. And I'm going to give you an example of this. I was asked when I was on the New York City Planning Commission to take Jack Welch, who used to be the CEO of GE, around some of New York City's landmarks. And I took him to the Channon Building. The Channon Building is on 42nd and Madison, is a great Art Deco palace in New York City. It is encrusted with, it's what this place should look like when you get some more money. Let's not go into that. He's had a long day. And he's looking at around at this fantastic Art Deco palace for workers. It's, you know, it's your usual 26-story high office building with inlaid glass insets and the doors, wonderful door handles and so on. And he looked at me and he said, "This is outrageous. People who work here would think they belong here." Now, this is, my eyebrows went up. This was an official function. I couldn't really, I had to ask him a question. So I said, "Well, what do you mean?" He said, "At GE, I make sure that all the offices pretty much look the same so that nobody feels they have a right to be there." Now, that is, it's a pithy and rather, horrific story. But it embodies a kind of great truth, which is that you mark space when you think that you have a durable relation to it. And if you're running an economy in which durable relation loses its meaning, the marking of space becomes something negative. Right? You don't have a right of possession. It's one of the reasons that so-called flexible offices look like the inside of refrigerators. You know, they are meant absolutely to represent the conditions of work that go on there, which is nobody has a home here. Right? Virtual office, same sort of thing. Neutralization is a way of marking flexibilization, Understand, you understand what I'm talking about. To be sure, standardization of buildings also results from their global currency as investment units. I mean, they have to be, as David Harvey was talking about the other day, they have to have some of this, of the transparency of money. If I'm in Jakarta and I want to buy an office building in London, I need to know what I'm getting. And the more it's standardized, the more an office means the same thing all over the globe, the more I'm able to deal in that kind of transparency of exchange. The third element of standardization, of this kind of economy breeding standardization, is now that obviously in the realm of standardized consumption, which is so different from Zimmel's Berlin. There's a kind of reversal, so that a very jagged and often chaotic form of production produces a very standardized realm of public consumption. It's a total reversal of the process that existed a century ago. And all of these forces of standardization beget indifference. Benjamin's image of the flaneur gets a new, meaning in a world of Starbucks and Nike towns. There's not much curiosity about what you're going to find. It's known. It's a world in which the subject's tastes, the subject's desire, is finally marked. Similarly, the accumulation of shared history, and so of memory, diminishes in such public places. And that, again, is parallel to the attack on accumulated, ingrown, shared histories in the work world. Just as flexibility takes aim at workers' deadwoods, that's people my age, who have grown attached to a company, who have long memories of its institutional history, and tries to put in its place instead the notion of right now, of nothing having accumulated from the past. So these public spaces bear the marks of places from which time has been erased. Right? There's no long history in them. Nobody remembers, if a Nike town disappears, that it once was there, certainly not with any affection. Okay. Now, the third element, so that is a negative about flexibility and indifference. The third element here has to do with the relationship in urban space between what is the, as a sociologist I will say to you, I think is the greatest conflict that this new capitalism has produced. And that is a conflict between flexible work and family life. And you can understand that conflict immediately. If I said to you, let's raise a child so that he or she has low levels of commitment to people in the family, that they're looking for opportunities, you know, wherever they can find them, and they're going to move as soon as they find them, that they don't get too involved and too ingrown, we would have produced an absolutely monstrous young human being. But those are exactly the values of flexible work. And what I and the researchers who have been studying this conflict with me have found is that in the end, cutting across class strata, the notion of that somehow the ways in which adults survive in the work world are not ways they want to teach children to grow up. One of the great, great dramas of this modern capitalism. It impacts on our subject, on the city, and that what we have found is that for people who are caught in this, who are trying to create some kind of order and stability and even rigidity in family life, to oppose the flux and uncertainty of the work world, are people who tend to withdraw from civic commitments. I hate to put this as kind of sociological rule, but it's, and by the time we get this study done, I think we can assert it fairly comfortably, that as people focus on what Christopher Lash once called about another capitalism, creating a haven in a heartless world, creating some kind of resistance to the flux of this capitalism and family life. They tend to withdraw from civic engagement. If you read my book, Corrosion of Character, you'll see an example of this that I give in there of a group of IBM programmers. This gives a different turn, in a way, to the issue of what we mean by indifference. And I can sharpen it for you in this way. A political scientist at Harvard, Robert Putnam, who's been studying civic withdrawal, has essentially attributed to kind of either the influence of TV, that is, you're so zonked out in front of the tube that you have no time to go out to your local community board meeting, or to a kind of loss of moral fiber within citizens. I think that's a wrong view. I think people are driven to withdraw from the public realm, particularly the public realm of civic engagement in cities, out of a feeling that the urgent business they have to do outside of work is create a protected private realm of the family, a realm in which they can stabilize what is unstable outside the family's doors. In other words, that indifference in this sense is not a kind of moral failing, it's a consequence of a contradiction in capitalism. In sum, when a society's organizational bureaucratic forms alter, both the experience of time and space alters. This conjoined alteration in the time of labor and the space of cities is what we are living through today. It's expressed in geographic impermanence, in the effects of flexible capitalism on the standardization of the public realm, and on the creation and on the conflict between flexibility and intimate life, which produces as one of its offshoots civic withdrawal. Now, I said that this is my argument to you, tout court. I said to you that, of course, globalization is also a player in this. And as you know from the other three lectures in this modernization series, the meaning of the term globalization is a highly contested one. Good old-fashioned Marxists just think it's more of old-fashioned corporate, multicultural corporate imperialism writ large. Other people like Saskia Sassen believe it's really a new event, as does Tony Giddens. The one thing I'd like to mention about globalization in regard to the issue of this dialectic between flexibility and indifference is this. What the role of citizenship plays, urban citizenship plays, in globalization. What I want to argue to you is that globalized regimes, work regimes in the city, wish to operate in the city but not rule it. It is a regime which wants to install itself in urban space, but not be the master of the city as a whole. And in that way, these regimes achieve power without responsibility. And let me very quickly explain to you what I mean by this, by giving an example. In Worth, Chicago, in 1925, political and economic power were coextensive. Presidents of the city's top 80 corporations sat on 142 hospital boards. They comprised 70% of trustees of colleges and universities. Political machines were deeply linked to these businesses, and tax revenues from the 18 national corporations located in Chicago formed 23% of the city's municipal budget. By contrast, in New York now, which is with London the world's most globalized city, political and economic power are not coextensive in this way. The global economy is not rooted in the city in the sense of depending on control of the city's territory. It is an island economy within the island of Manhattan, or for you, the Docklands, which is a great image of the same sort of thing, as though a giant helicopter bearing billions had set down on the river's edge. Wealth does not trickle down or seep out very much from these global islands within the city. It's an issue that's treated very much more at length by theorists of what's called dual city hypothesis, who'd have tried to show, in fact, the barriers between the trickle-out or trickle-down or seepage-out of this global economy into the city at large. For example, in New York, the top 23 firms in the city in New York pay only 9% of its taxes. And one reason for this is what Proust calls, in an entirely different context, the passed beloved phenomenon. That is, if you threaten to leave, if you say, I'm a corporation, I can go anywhere, I don't need you, the response is, oh, don't go, we'll give you a break, we'll lower your taxes. Within the realm of civil society, similarly in New York, big players in the global economy, which is located in New York, are absent from most of the city's civic enterprises, such as hospitals, libraries, universities, and schools. In other words, globalization poses a problem in cities just the way it does in nations. I remark that the conflicting demands on family and work are now diminishing civic participation. But here, in the global realm, is another much less sympathetic form of civic indifference, and particularly urgent at the top of global organizations. Cities can't tap into the wealth of these corporations, and the corporations take little responsibility for their own presence of the city. Something, if I may remark, which is absolutely amazing to me about the debates going on about what should happen to London now. We talk about selling, who's going to sell these bloody bonds in the tube, but not who is going to control the corporations in the city, how to distribute the incredible wealth in London to people who live here. It's a kind of blank out, as though we've accepted the notion that they're in the city, but not of it. That these engines of incredible wealth, and this is, you know, we are in the middle of the wealthiest part of the entire globe, wealthier than Tokyo, center of London, have no responsibility for the place that allows them to accumulate this wealth. The threat of absence, of leaving, makes possible this avoidance of responsibility. And we lack correspondingly the political mechanisms to make unstable, flexible institutions contribute fairly for the privileges they enjoy in the city. Now, for all of these reasons, I want to argue that the dialectics of flexibility and indifference pose three dilemmas for cities: a dilemma of citizenship, of arousal in the public realm, and finally, the dilemma of the sheer meaning of place, of the feeling of attachment to place. The political economy of a century ago posed the problem of how to cut free from rigidity. The city embodied that rigidity in its ecology, but paradoxically in the newness and rawness of the urban population. The very concentration of strangers seemed also to promise an escape from rigidity, from Weber's iron cage, a promise of freedom. We now have cities of globally mobile corporations, flexible workers, a dynamic capitalism bent on erasing routine. But paradoxically, in this city, this restless economy produces political disengagement, a standardization of the political realm, and new pressures to withdraw into the private sphere. Now, I'd like to conclude this lecture very briefly by asking what this new kind of city, marked by the relation between flexibility and indifference, implies about the two ethical values for which the city, in my mind, durably stands. About the sociability of living with strangers. The mark of the public realm now is mutual accumulation through dissociation, the truce of letting one another alone, the peace of mutual indifference. What it's about, in other words, is identity rather than alterity. We've almost entirely lost the desire to mix classes or races together if that threatens violence. In German cities, which the peripheralization of immigrants is accepted as a matter of course, it creates a more peaceable realm. There's no threat of explosion, of encounter, of finding something different. That's what it means to define a public realm in terms of mutual accommodation through dissociation. It's based on identity rather than alterity. Mutual accommodation through dissociation spells, in my view, the end of citizenship, as well as marking a loss of simple human curiosity about the other. So that's, I think, what the corrosive effect that this new capitalist city has had on the issue of alterity. It's replaced alterity by difference. It's created a public realm in which accommodation through indifference is a guarantor of public order. About subjectivity, personal experience of the incomplete, in one way, should seem achieved by this new capitalist time. Flexible time is serial rather than cumulative. You move from job to job, place to place, without a logic, a linear logic. The spaces of flexible time are unmarked, neutral. But what's missing here is that Levinasian bridge that I referred to at the beginning of this talk. There's no sense that because something seems missing in my own life, I ought to turn outward towards others, towards the neighborliness of strangers. This very problem of capitalist time, however, suggests something about the art of making cities better cities today. We want to overlay different activities in the same space, as, for example, creating family activity and working space. The incompleteness of capitalist time returns us to the issue which marked the very emergence of the industrial city, a city which broke apart the domus, that spatial relation which had before the coming of industrial capitalism combined family, work, ceremonial public spaces, and more informal social spaces. Today, we need to repair the collectivity of space in order to combine the serial time of modern labor. And that's what I think the art of making cities is about. It's not rocket science. That's why, for those of you who know what we're doing in the cities program, we study things like how wide are the sidewalks, or whether people can sit on bollards. This is not rocket science. It's a political activity, because it requires even more than whatever visual sophistication and scholarship one brings to the issue of sociability, the willingness to the grounding, the desire to engage the other. And that's finally what makes cities worth living in. Thank you very much. Thank you very much. Can I say that I hate questions, but that I'll do it because evidently that's your tradition. But ask me a question. Don't tell me where I'm wrong.
But there are a couple of roving mics, both downstairs and upstairs. So I'll leave you to pick your interrogators.
So kind. You're so kind. You always leave me in the lurch, in poker as well as in life. Who would like to ask me?
I'll answer the questions for you if you like.
You could. This I do like. Yes.
Thank you. In your vision of the city of the future, is there any role for civic leadership, by which I'm probably mean specifically mayors, because we're quite interested in that at this moment?
Do you want to ask me about the mayor? Well, I think this is sort of, in a way, look, this. I mean, I just say this to you as an outsider. This is incredibly entertaining, what's going on in London, but it is not at all serious, what I find extraordinary is that you have wound up with a situation with a mayor who has very little power, right? The likelihood that you have this kind of vendetta that's worthy of Puccini, really, it doesn't belong in the realm of politics at all, which will have the effect of absolutely blocking off any possibility of the city itself acting, right? It's very clear that the defeat, assuming Livingston gets elected, that he's not going to be allowed to achieve much. And that means that we'll suffer. The problem to me about this in a more general way, because I mean, people always ask me about that, and that's when I wrap myself in the sort of foreigner's garb about this. May I say, by the way, that just one thing about this. I talked to some people in Chicago. I explained to them the contest for the labor contest, nomination contest. Then they looked at me in absolute surprise. The reactions on their faces were something like, it's over the top. Even in Chicago, that wouldn't be possible, and so on. I mean, it's a situation of farce or melodrama. But I think in a more serious way, the problem that, although this is serious, because we'll have this totally blocked city out of these characters, but the more serious problem is how you and how we can actually make the social experience of living with people who are different translate into a kind of politics. There's a great failure of urban democracy in the last 20 years. It's something, as an American living in is very, very prominent to us in terms of racial politics, in terms of race. We have very segregated cities racially. The races never encounter each other. There's an absolutely fixed set of discourses about, you know, New York, which revolve around white guilt and, you know, black rage, and so nothing happens. The problem for me is how do you translate that actual on-the-ground experience of encountering somebody rather than classifying them into something that is political? And in my own view, that means radically decentralizing forms of power. It would mean, in your case, that local councils would own, say, the hospitals that they have. That instead of Chris Woodhead, you would have every council would totally control its own schools. When I talked to people in labor about this, they said, but this is the bad old days of corruption. Well, you know, that's a very funny word, corruption. It's also saying the unmanaged. Right? Corruption isn't the worst thing that can happen to a city. You know, indifference, passivity is. So at a kind of serious level, I think what we as Londoners have been cursed with is a reform of the city, which in fact really precludes, to my mind, this serious issue about urban citizenship which modern capitalism predisposes, which is how to break this cycle of indifference from the top with these corporations down to the practices of everyday life. And my own belief about that, and that's why I've come to this city's program, is that one of the means of creating that citizenship is not more meaning, more meetings, right, more bureaucracy, but creating urban spaces in which people have those encounters, you know, that the democracy may liken the architecture of the city rather than its bureaucracy, you know. But that is, in my view, the problem that's faced here. And I think it's a great sadness that this farce has occluded the opportunity to make London a more democratic, to discuss this kind of issue about what does it actually mean to have urban democracy. And hey, I'm sorry to give you such a long time.
We need short answers because there are quite a few.
I'm very, very sorry.
We should maybe take someone from up top.
Yeah,
there.
Can you speak?
Richard, you said that more and more global corporations are retiring from the public realm. On the other side, they are sponsoring universities and more determining what the contents of the research. So what would you say is the effect of that flexible bureaucracy on academic research
well,
and teaching?
It's a really interesting question. I mean, on one hand, it's much cheaper to give the LSE £1 million than it is, you know, to serve on the board of a hospital. You know, the responsibility is less. It's nicer to give money to the arts than it is to schools. But just as a material fact, as a statistical fact, partially because many of the people who run these global organizations are not citizens of the place where they work, their ability, you know, to behave as citizens and to be called to account as citizens is very much diminished. So there's a both economic and a kind of political reason why it isn't just the substitution of a new form of engagement by the old. That's a short answer. How about one other question? And then I feel like I've earned a scotch. Yes, back here.
Actually, there are a couple of things, really. the first thing.
I think one question would do. Then maybe Richard take another one. You never know.
Yeah.
You never know.
You never know.
We will. We'll know very shortly. Huh?
Yeah. Ask
it's me. Really about indifference, and I was interested in the way in which you were drawing on Zimmel. So Zimmel actually uses the notion of indifference himself and talks about the ways in which the money economy has developed to produce indifference. So I was wondering about that shift and whether that
what is interesting about Zimmel is that the modulation from the, just since you asked me an academic question, I'll give you an academic answer. The modulation from the philosophy of money to what happens when he writes essays like The Stranger, Metropolis, and Middle Life, and so on. Once place enters the picture, right, indifference assumes another character, becomes the mask, and behind it there's a kind of subjective development and engagement, right? A reaction to alterity. And if you remember in The Metropolis and Mental Life, what he's talking about is that mask is also created by overstimulation, right? The crowd for Zimmel, as it is for Le Bon, is an intensely stimulating phenomenon. They imagine crowds to be supercharged in a way that somebody moving from Nike Town to Starbucks does not imagine them to be. Let me take one final.
Let's just have one more to relieve Richard of his ordeal.
No, it's not an ordeal. It's just go ahead.
One, two. Okay. This is my question, Mr. Sennett.
One only. Yeah. One, two.
All right. Speaking of cities having democracy built into their architecture and needing places for encounters of various kinds, do you have any comment whatsoever on the recent decision to close Russell Square at night?
How could you do this to me? You mean Trafalgar Square? Ah, well, this is news to me, and that's good, because I can't comment on something I don't know about. This is a very long, in a way, again, as I say, it's not rocket science, but it's serious stuff. Does pedestrianization really get people to notice each other? And how do you engineer, design pedestrianization so that that occurs? That is why you should enroll in the Cities program, for which you can spend month after month obsessing about exactly problems like that. Thank you very much.